We learned this week that Apple is a $1 trillion company. The next one could be Amazon. And the owner of that company is Jeff Bezos, who is the richest man in the world, worth about $150 billion. Bill Gates comes in at number two by a wide $55 billion margin. Bezos has twice as much money as Mark Zuckerberg. Writer Annie Lowry calls this wealth a policy failure and an indictment of the tax system and business regulations. She writes about this in The Atlantic. She's also author of the new book, Give People Money. Annie Lowry, welcome to Here and Now. And first, just put in context how much Bezos is worth compared to the average person and how fast his wealth is growing.
So he actually at this point has so much wealth that he would have to spend almost $30 million a day to just stop accumulating wealth, given prevailing rates of market growth. He's worth about 2 million times what the average American family is worth. He's the world's lone centibillionaire, the only man or person who is worth more than $100 billion. And so this is an unusual amount in both sort of nominal terms. It's just a really big number, but also in historical terms. And so it's a really, really big sum.
And Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg, also extremely rich, have promised to give away much of their fortune. But Jeff Bezos sees things differently. What does he want to do with his money?
So he's kind of sat on it unusually. So Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, Mark Zuckerberg, and many of the other folks who are up at the very top of the wealth scale there have basically said that they're going to give, 99% or even more than 99% away. So obviously Bill Gates has the Gates Foundation. Mark Zuckerberg has set up his Zuckerberg Chan initiative. But Jeff Bezos hasn't done anything like that yet. And he's made some controversial comments, basically saying that he's not sure that there is enough to philanthropically spend his money on, even just here on Earth. He's plowing a lot of it into his sort of interstellar initiatives. But he hasn't sort of done what some of his peers have done in terms of just starting to give it away in his lifetime.
Now, you write that Bezos's wealth is a credit to him, but you also say that he, quote, did not just make his $150 billion, we gave it to him. What do you mean by that?
This is not to take anything away from him or the ingenuity of his business or how market changing and market dominant that Amazon is. However, we have a tax system and a business and regulatory environment that does encourage wealth accumulation. So there's some kind of obvious ways that that happens and then less obvious ways that that happens. So one kind of obvious way is that the taxes on capital gains, basically, your taxes on assets, are lower than taxes
on income,
on earned income. So like wages and salaries at the top end.
The capital gains taxes is 15% is the highest amount that it can be. And the other income taxes can go up almost to 40%.
Exactly. So if you're quite wealthy and you're making a big salary, you're going to pay a top tax rate right now of 35%, whereas if you have that long-term capital gain, it's often going to be taxed at 10 or 15%. So that's one kind of obvious way that this happens. But there are other ways that government policy encourages corporate profitability and therefore shareholder wealth. So one way that's less obvious is that the government has allowed more and more market concentration. So it's allowed companies to become monopolies or monopsonies. And Amazon is an example of this. It's very dominant in certain market sectors like book selling and in e-commerce more broadly. And that can have a wage suppressing effect and also an effect in terms of making the company itself more wealthy. And, there's a number of these ways that are quite subtle but quite powerful that demonstrate why we have a stock market that's delivering really extraordinary returns, but you have middle class and lower income families that are kind of just treading water.
Do you think that Amazon, which, by the way, pays its workers at the low end of the scale, they're actually making less than what's considered a living wage in this country. Do you think that they're having an effect on wages overall just by their sheer size?
There's some evidence that in markets that they move into, they do have a somewhat wage-suppressing effect. Idea being that they're kind of the only game in town. Their workers are not unionized, and therefore they can, you know, pay perhaps slightly sub-market rates. Again, that lack of market competition in some places, combined with the lack of private sector unionization rates, really means that, you know, benefits can get workers fairly cheaply. And what's kind of funny is that Amazon pays its warehouse workers not terribly, certainly. You know, all of their jobs are above the federal minimum wage and often quite above it. But the problem is that wages, as a general point, have really just not kept up with the pace of growth. And so, you know, whether that's, I would hesitate to say that that's a phenomenon that's necessarily totally unique to Amazon. It's really something that we're seeing economy-wide.
One of the things that you point out in your piece is that Amazon paid no corporate income taxes last year, which is pretty incredible given how well the company is doing.
It is pretty extraordinary. So after Donald Trump passed his tax cuts last year, the effective rate of income tax on corporations. And it's important to caveat that with the note that companies only ever pay income tax if they are actually profitable. So, you know, many businesses that are not profitable are under no obligation to pay that tax. The effective rate is now just 9%, which is about 75% of the effective income tax rate on American households. So corporations pay less tax than households do, both in nominal terms and as a share of their profits now. And, you know, that tax rate is quite low. And then, you know, big companies are engaging in very gymnastic efforts to avoid those taxes and are very, very good at it.
Well, and Amazon in particular is going around the country trying to get every single city and state to give them huge tax breaks to move their second headquarters there.
Indeed. So they've had this kind of sort of bachelor or bachelorette type contest where cities have been offering them billions and billions and billions of dollars in tax incentives to locate there, including some very unusual tax incentives. So, you know, in one case, for instance, they would be able to basically take some of the income tax revenue that their workers would be providing in state and local taxes, and they get to keep that. That's something that's been offered to them. And so, you know, it's likely that they will end up putting that second headquarter someplace that has offered them, you know, in the several billions of dollars of tax relief.
Some people may hear this and say, you know, Jeff Bezos earned his money. He had a really good idea. He's made a lot of money on it. He's employing a lot of people. What's wrong with that?
It's a good point, and it's not one that I disagree with. You know, I don't think that anybody is talking about confiscating the wealth of people that have made extraordinary contributions and really revolutionized business. But it's impossible to look at the wealth and income structure that we have in this country and see it as anything other than the result of policy. The reason that we used to have a much more equitable wealth and income distribution was because of policy. And so we've seen, due to changes like globalization and automation, along with other sort of policy changes, more concentration of wealth at the upper end. And that's not just a market outcome. That's also a policy issue. So again, I don't think that anybody is saying it's bad that people should be making billions of dollars for creating revolutionary businesses. But at the same time, I think it's a mistake to say that government should not respond in some way and should not have a structure that in some ways is taxing working families harder than it is taxing the owners of shares.
But when you look at the tax overhaul that was just passed by the Trump administration and Republicans in Congress, it makes it a lot easier on these, you know, mega billionaires and not that much easier on working families. And it doesn't look like we're moving in the opposite direction now. In fact, the Trump administration is proposing more tax cuts for the wealthy.
Indeed, Trump's tax cuts are going to have a regressive effect, right? So they are providing tax relief primarily to very high income families and to corporations. There's some tax relief for folks who are kind of in the middle and the lower end of the income distribution. But this is going to have the effect of exaggerating these trends that we've been seeing, whereas many economists would argue and many policy folks would argue that perhaps we should be doing, you know, a little bit of the opposite, providing more help to middle and lower income families and asking more of corporations and the rich, given that they're the ones that have benefited from the last decade of economic growth overwhelmingly.
Annie Lowrey, when you heard yesterday that Apple became a trillion-dollar company, what did you think? Does that sound like good news or bad news to you?
You know, it's funny. I think that obviously it's another one of these companies that's amazing and revolutionary and wonderful and has changed the world and has advanced things. Yet at the same time, I think that these same concerns come into play. What does that mean for average folks? What does it mean if these trends just continue exaggerating? And what's stopping us from making different choices to help ensure that the fruits of economic growth are really shared by everybody?
That's Annie Lowrey, a contributing editor at The Atlantic. We will link you to her piece at hereandnow.org. Annie, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.